Well, hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Weekly Pulse. I'm Jeff Snyder, founder and CEO of The Morning Pulse, and your host for the next 40-plus minutes as we go around the globe to discuss the issues around retirement, markets, technology, and personal finance. We've got another great show this week. Of course, I'll be joined by the All-Stars, and our special guest is Bob Otter of CitizenAid. So check that out. Sit back, relax, and enjoy this episode of
Welcome back, everyone, and we're going to kick things off, as we always do every week, with Mr. Devin Banerjee, Senior Finance Editor with LinkedIn, and he's going to weigh in on what some of the top social media themes were for the week. Hi, Devin, how are you?
Pretty good, Jeff. How are you?
I am good. I'm a little tired. It's been a wild National Retirement Security Week, but I'm prepped and ready to go, and I'm excited to have you kind of weigh in on what's going on the LinkedIn platform, which has over 600 million subscribers worldwide, and what you're seeing there and across the internet, basically. So what say you?
Yeah, absolutely, Jeff. I know all the topics we discuss are important, but this week I think we saw some particularly important topics really taking off on social media. The first one was a report from LeanIn.org and McKinsey about female workplace representation. So in this study of a survey of more than 64,000 U.S. employees, McKinsey and LeanIn found that about 20% reported that they were often or always the only female employee in a room. Mm-hmm. And for people in senior or technical roles, this percentage jumped to 40%. So like the consequences, you know, of being the only woman in the room, if you think about it, was often needing to like provide additional evidence of their competence or regularly being mistaken for someone junior. A lot of them reported that, or facing demeaning comments, or the worst, obviously being subject to harassment. And so this was a really important study. I read through the entire thing. It really took off on social media. The president of LeanIn, Rachel Thomas, wrote a great piece on LinkedIn and shared it across social media that you should take a look at, just about six things companies can and should do to make progress on gender diversity. So obviously always an important topic, but this report, which they've done several years now, is just a real nice sort of way to track progress and also to hear directly from, as I mentioned, 64,000 women in the workplace.
Yeah, and based on what's gone over the last year especially, it's kind of surprising to me that some of those reactions that you illustrated, you talked about. So hopefully there can be greater progress. You know, certainly sharing these things on LinkedIn and other social networks helps stimulate the conversation, changes people's thinking over time, and hopefully we can make even greater progress, because we certainly want diversity of opinion, we want diversity of ideas, and we want everybody represented in the boardroom and across businesses to contribute. And, you know, I think that's – I'll leave it there, but I think that's so important and vital.
Yeah, and I think what you mentioned about what's happened, you know, recently in corporate culture and also in our entertainment culture and stuff, I think the openness with which people are discussing important topics is certainly increasing, and I think at least we can all agree that that's important. Which leads me to our next item that really took off on social media, which was this survey and this research about how willing people are to talk about pay. So researchers at Harvard Business School and UCLA found that 80% of workers would be willing to pay to prevent their salaries from being disclosed to their coworkers. So this is, you know, obviously kind of the opposite of transparency. But the interesting thing is people are still really curious. So 69% said they actually did want to know how their salary stacks up against their peers. And 72% said they believe in transparency on this topic. So kind of an interesting dichotomy here between people who don't want to disclose their pay but want to know how it stacks up against their coworkers. And so, you know, people might be wondering, why is this important at all? Well, you know, researchers and advocates argue that openness could improve productivity and satisfaction, but most importantly, it could improve pay equity. If you know how you stack up against someone at your similar level, especially say if there's gender or racial bias occurring, this might be an important step to close that gap. So we see, as with many of these topics that we discussed, Jeff, we see people on both ends of the spectrum in favor and opposed. But just an interesting discussion on social media we saw this week about this research and the survey about people's willingness to talk about pay.
Yeah, and then you've got websites like Glassdoor, which we're not necessarily endorsing, but
right.
They provide some kind of insight. But you've got to voluntarily, I think, it's not like they're getting W-2 information from an employer. You've got to voluntarily provide feedback. But, I think there's when you're going in for a raise or you're going in to discuss compensation, it's always helpful to kind of know where your peers are and, you know, whether men, women, people of the same experience level, geographically where they are. That always helps in kind of the negotiation process.
Of course, absolutely. And I'll wrap up with two interesting workplace trends we saw that people really paid attention to this week on social media. The first one, you know, obviously here in the U.S. on November 6th, we have the midterm elections, very important. So we're starting to see, you know, every 2 years with elections, more companies offering paid time off to their employees in order to vote. So the Society for Human Resources Management found that 44% of U.S. companies are offering some paid time for their employees to vote, and that's up from 37% in the 2016 election. So some improvement there. I'm not sure anyone would disagree that at least voting is so important. Whether companies would allow employees to vote during work time is obviously up to different employers, but just an interesting trend to follow. And I think maybe some kind of like ESG mindset is a way that I've heard some CEOs frame why they're doing this. So I was at this conference a week ago, and the CEO of TPG, the big private equity firm, said that they're actually closing all their U.S. offices for the day to allow people to vote. And he said that's part of an ESG mindset. So definitely part of that larger ESG trend. And the last trend I'll touch on, Jeff, which might not be a trend because it's one company that's doing it, and it's actually one company in Japan, but it sparked a real interesting conversation, which is it's giving employees points. It's using a point system if they get a full night's sleep.
Huh.
And so if they sleep more than 6 hours a night for 5 days in a week, they earn points, and they can redeem or exchange those points at their cafeteria for food that can be valued at up to $600 a year. So one company, obviously, but again, part of this larger mindset of employers caring more about their employees.
So how do they track? I mean, did they say how they actually track the sleep?
It says it'll be tracked via an app. So I guess there's an app that employees can, for example, place on their bed or track when they go to sleep and when they wake up. I guess, to your point, there might be ways that employees can sort of hack the app or get around it.
Wow.
It'll be interesting to see how successful, you know, this company is in tracking it.
Well, interesting. And it's good to see in these last two, especially, the voting, allowing people to do their civic duty, especially in this country, very important. And I had no idea that, you know, sarcastically, I had no idea there were midterm elections coming up. I would never know by watching television or even looking at social media. But Devin, always a pleasure. Thanks for the interesting insights. Wonderful as always. And we'll catch up with you next week.
Absolutely. Sounds good, Jeff. Have a great weekend.
You too, bud. Bye. Welcome back, and now we're going to talk to Ms. Natalie Walter. She's the tech reporter from The Motley Fool. Natalie, how are you?
Doing great. Enjoying the weather right now. Excited about Halloween.
It is, yeah. Any plans to dress up for Halloween? Any costume, or are you just going to be trick-or-treating?
I'm always a last-minute planner, but 2 days ago, I Amazon Primed myself a simple costume. I'm going to be Barb from Stranger Things, if you know.
That's a Netflix series, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. I've kind of been rewatching it. So I got inspired and I just bought a $20 shirt, and then I'm just going to wear my jeans with that.
And you are I think you're aspiring. You like to work behind the scenes. We've talked about this in other segments. You like to work behind the scenes on some of these shows. And I think it just kind of dovetails nicely into your Halloween costume.
I do. I'm kind of fascinated by TV and film, and I just love the whole world and the creative process. So
Well,
Yeah, I think Stranger Things is so well made.
very cool. Maybe I'll check it out this weekend. So let's talk. I think you're going to talk about Netflix, kind of some up and down reporting on Netflix this week.
Yes. Yeah, so Netflix is one of my favorite companies to cover. I think it's just a new company, and I use it and all my friends use it, so it's interesting to kind of follow its story arc, and it's just kind of blossomed so quickly over the past 5 years. I think a lot of people forget that it didn't get into original content until 5 years ago when it released House of Cards. That was its first original scripted content, and now it's already in the big leagues.
Wow.
Last month it won 23 Emmys, which means it tied with HBO, even though HBO has been doing this far, far longer, since the 19, I think late 1970s. So Netflix has had a quick rise, and it reported earnings last week, and it added 7 million subscribers worldwide, which was more than it was predicting. So people were pleasantly surprised with that. And it now has 137 million subscribers worldwide, which is just a stunning number. But of course, it's adding more subscribers internationally right now than the US, because the US is pretty saturated right now. In fact, about half of all US households right now have Netflix.
Wow,
Isn't that crazy?
it is crazy. I mean, they've seen considerable growth, and we've talked about this on the show. They've spent $8 billion on content, which is amazing. I mean, do you think that there's a do you think there's a saturation point where, they can't add any more because they have everyone? I mean, there are people in developing countries that probably don't have access to. Or in the emerging markets that don't necessarily have access to technology or the internet on a regular basis. So maybe there's some limitations to how much they can grow.
And in the US, Netflix has said in the past it hopes to reach at the top end about 90 million subscribers. So that means it would have about 30 million more to add. But at the low end, it said, maybe hitting 60 million. But it's almost at that 60 million, so I'm guessing it's aiming more for 90 million in the US. But yeah, abroad, it's been working hard to capture more of that international audience so it can keep growing. And it's doing that by producing local shows. So they go into different countries and they find local content creators. They do it in the language of the country. And, it costs more, but it helps Netflix stand out from the competition. And that's how it's been growing worldwide. It thought, if our original shows have helped us grow in the US, why can't we do that in other countries too? And that's what's been helping it. And as for the US, it's trying to figure out how do we get those last sort of stubborn households to sign up for our program. So it's been using a few different strategies. One of those is bundling. So now you can pay for Netflix on your Comcast bill. So it's just one bill. It cuts out friction for signing up for Netflix. It makes it more convenient. And other ways are they are partnering up with different devices where maybe you sign on to your Roku TV or something, and a Netflix button will pop up that'll let you easily subscribe to it. So just making it really easy for those people who weren't early adopters, maybe aren't as tech savvy, to sign up for their program, just making it super easy to get those last few people to sign up for it.
Interesting. I read something, and I may have been on The Motley Fool. If not, I'm sorry. But it was something that discussed the debt that Netflix has taken on because it's creating content. And I'm wondering if you maybe had thought about that in your, because you like to cover this company. A lot of money being spent on content. Some of it's great quality, like you mentioned, semi Stranger Things, Orange is the New Black. But some of it. I'm not it, I, personally. I'm not a fan of some of it. I love Last Chance U and some other things, but just wondering what your perspective is on ringing up the debt, greater debt to create content.
So there's it seems like people either love Netflix and are kind of ignoring that problem, or they only focus on that problem and they don't really even want to consider Netflix as a long-term potential company. And it's definitely something people need to be looking at. They're continuing to borrow money to fund these expensive shows. I think they just borrowed $2 billion more dollars or something last week. So,
Wow.
they're getting money from their subscribers, but not enough. And they said in the earnings call, this is going to break even in eventually, you know, it might take a few more years, but eventually we'll have enough subscribers that we won't need to borrow money anymore. But, you know, it's not happening right now, and it's hard to predict the future. So I think that's definitely something for people to pay attention to.
Yep. One word on that, Amazon, right? Long period, long track record, but it doesn't always work out. Natalie, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your wisdom and insight. And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Have a great weekend.
Great. Sounds good. Have a great weekend.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, welcome back, everyone. And now it's time for our market segment. And joining us now from Money Management Academy is Mr. George Grombacher. And from Delphi Digital, he's a principal there, Mr. Kevin Kelly. Guys, how are you?
What's going on?
Awesome.
Same old, same old. I'm still married. It's been, first week of marriage has been great. But the markets have not been – they've been a little up and down, Kevin. You know, what say you on that?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's definitely been an interesting week. I think we even talked about this, you know, probably about a month ago, where we said a lot of the global equity markets were starting to get into a bit of a free fall, most notably emerging market stocks. Like if you look at the Chinese stock market, I mean, that's been really, really beaten down, you know, in the last couple months. But at the same time, the S&P 500 and U.S. stocks continue to rise higher. So the question was, you know, 3-4 weeks ago, how long that divergence would persist. And what we're seeing now is that part of that, I think part of this kind of global equity market route has now shifted to the U.S. So it's a little bit more risk off. The second part is, you know, if you think about what's really driven the equity market recovery this year, there's a lot of optimism surrounding earnings and people saying, listen, the markets, you know, the economic data coming in is better than expected. You know, it's not quite time to, you know, ring the alarm bells and fire sale a lot of stocks because, you know, the fundamental backdrop's great. Well, if you fast forward to this quarter, you know, there's been some mixed results. I mean, you're still U.S. equities are still tracing a very strong earnings season. But at the same time, when you look at the analyst expectations for earnings moving forward, those are not as supportive as they used to be. So the real concern here is if this trend continues, the market breaks a few of these key technical levels that a lot of people have really been pointing to. And, you know, the next leg lower might still be out there. So, yeah, I mean, that's just kind of at a high level, you know, what I'm seeing this week.
Yeah, George, I'm going to come to you in a minute, but I want to ask you, Kevin, about the impact potentially of the U.S. midterm elections. You know, that's something that we're 2 weeks away, basically, 2 weeks from or a week and a half away from the midterms, which could have an impact on the shift of power at the U.S. Congress and the U.S. Senate. Does that weigh into the markets? Do you think the markets build that into what we're seeing, or is that just not even built in?
I think it's a complicated question. There's no right. I don't think there's a right answer. And the reason I say that is because as we get closer, it seems like there's been a little bit more volatility as the midterms have approached. But when you look back, you know, historically at certain periods, this one might be a little bit different than prior periods because obviously there's been a lot of focus on this year's midterms. But when you look back at midterms in the past, oftentimes it really hasn't gotten factored into markets unless there's something drastic that happens, right? So I think what'll be interesting to see if there is that shift of power, what that'll mean for policy going forward. Obviously, you have a very involved president, as we're all aware, tweeting. I mean, no one's really safe in this environment, not even, you know, Fed Chairman Powell. So I think this time is, you know, hesitant to say, obviously, this time is different, but I think there is a lot more scrutiny being put on these midterms. And some of that is, you know, potentially getting baked into to recent price action.
George, let me come to you. One of the reasons why I really love having you on the show is because you're out there talking to plan sponsors, employers, and participants, and you're really focused on engaging people in education around these events. What are you hearing on the street from average investors?
Well, I think many of us began the week thinking we were going to be billionaires.
But it's true.
Being that I have no clients in South Carolina, it is back to the drawing board for many of us and going back to the plain old boring qualified plan investing. But as we oftentimes talk about, it's always unsettling for sort of the average investor that doesn't understand the markets and doesn't understand all the different variables that go into what makes these big swings happen. But always work really hard to coach people up and help them have a long-term plan for, yeah, when the market dips and has a correction like it just did, how am I going to respond? And it's kind of like a personal investor policy statement, like all big organizations have. They have their policy statements in place, which kind of act as a guardrail, so that like, try to take emotions out of it. But never an easy thing.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's shift gears. Kevin, one of your new roles now is to oversee research around digital assets. A lot of talk around Bitcoin, Ethereum, other digital assets. What are some of the trends that you're picking up on as an organization?
Yeah. So one of my partners and I were actually out at an investment conference this week called the Crypto Invest Summit out in Los Angeles, which was a great time, a great learning experience. Met a lot of really interesting people working on different projects within the space. I would say the big kind of takeaways for us were that, you know, despite all the headlines and the market prices within the digital asset space, there were still, I mean, a very, very large number of participants at the conference. A lot of people still very excited about the space. A lot of people building the technology and the infrastructure that's going to support this space or hopes to support this space long term. And that's on both. We've seen a bit of a shift from investors going from buying into these, what we'll call more publicly traded tokens and coins and things like that, like the Bitcoins and the Ethers of the world, into some of the private investments, right? So there's a number of companies, VC companies, private equity firms that are looking at some of these projects and teams that are building the infrastructure and taking equity positions in those companies. So it's a little bit of a shift of how people are actually getting exposure to this. I don't think the public market prices entirely capture that. But the big takeaway for us is that, you know, despite all of the kind of market turmoil in the digital asset space, there's still a ton of people that are extremely excited about it. And it's kind of, you know, everyone seemed almost agnostic to prices and that the show goes on.
Yeah. And I think you're really bullish on the fact that an organization like Fidelity was kind of creating an exchange or infrastructure around that.
Yep, absolutely. I mean, we just to kind of really quickly recap, you know, what we were talking about last week or a couple weeks ago. Yeah, with Fidelity coming into the space, it's huge because one of the big reasons why a lot of institutions are not actually able to even invest, you know, even if they wanted to or their clients tell them that they want to, is because of the custody issues, the lack of custody solutions, I should say. And so with Fidelity moving into the space, offering digital asset custody, it really adds a lot more credibility to this market because there are a number of different custody companies that provide custody solutions for digital assets, but they're not kind of the household names that you would expect like a Fidelity. So Fidelity coming in long term, we think, is extremely, extremely bullish for the space.
And George, let's come to you. Two questions I want to ask you. I'm going to ask you one on your opinion about what Kevin said about digital assets. Number two, firstly, I want to ask you around target date funds. There's been a lot of things in the press this week around adding alternative investments, so private equity, hedge funds, direct real estate into the target date fund world. Currently, there's not a lot of that, but there's been some real advocacy. I want to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think that that's really a positive thing. I think that the more diversified that we can help the average American investor get with their retirement savings, the better. And so many retirement plan participants are in that target date space. So bringing more of those asset classes in, I think, helps to spread the risk out a little bit more. And I'll take that one step further. I think that we're going to see a lot of great benefits from artificial intelligence. I've been talking to a lot of startup companies or fintech companies recently that are working in that space and are really helping to or really working on improving the glide path as well, which is obviously a key part of target date investing.
So. Well, some would argue, including my new wife, that I need some artificial intelligence, and we're gonna leave it at that, gentlemen. Thanks for joining us, and look forward to catching up with you and the mysterious Oliver Rennick next week.
Thanks, man.
See you every weekend, guys.
Bye. welcome back. And if the audience recalls, maybe about 3 to 4 weeks ago, we had a great interview with Guy Pinkman. He's the firefighter captain out of Lincoln, Nebraska. And I wanted to carry that conversation forward. We've got a great guest now coming to us from Ohio. He is the co-founder and CEO of Citizen Aid, Mr. Robert Otter. Bob, how are you?
I'm well, Jeffrey. Thanks so much for your time and having me on your show.
Well, it's great. And like I mentioned in the intro, we had a great conversation with Guy Pinkman, you know, about his fire team, the importance of pensions and saving for retirement. And when I looked, you know, when you and I were chatting and obviously looked at your bio, you know, 23 years in the fire service, and you spent a lot of time as an EMT working in, you know, I would say triage and things like that. I want to start there. I want to start about with your experience and what it's like being a firefighter and an EMT to deal with some of these horrible events.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it's, you know, the fire service in general, you know, we call it the brotherhood, you know, sisterhood, but it was both guys and gals, but it's, it is definitely a calling. I mean, it's something that, all of us do. It's, not for the pay, but for the experience. And yeah, 23 years of, scene work and dealing with, some of the most mundane types of incidents to some of the most tragic, that you could comprehend. It's definitely been life altering and incredibly rewarding.
And when we were talking with Mr. Pinkman, I mean, and I want to get your perspective on this. I mean, when we look around the country, one of the issues that is popping up with pensions in particular, but with police and firefighters, is if the pension is not available or there's no retirement plan, sometimes that can be a disincentive for you know, recruiting employees. And I reference a story from the Louisville Fire Department, which had to be really come up with unique circumstances in order to attract employees to come work for them. So just want to get your perspective first on the importance of saving and planning, knowing that people in firefighting typically have, and police have typically have lower work years or less work years, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, the pension and knowing, you know, and that's the thing is, that can be attractive, though, to public servants because they can serve for 25 years and start at a relatively young age and then be fully vested. But yeah, obviously the importance of saving and, you know, a lot of the guys and gals nowadays are doing things outside of their pension. You know, they're starting their own portfolios and being progressive there just to make sure that all their bases are covered. Because again, you don't know because of injury or whatever it may be, how long your career in this occupation is going to be.
Absolutely. It's a hard job, obviously, for obvious reasons. It's a lot of traumatic things that you see. And I know that there's even instances of PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, that many firefighters and EMTs deal with. It's like being on the battlefield in some ways.
It is, and that's something that's really coming to the forefront now, and I'm glad the public is seeing at the civilian side because it's something that the fire service and law enforcement have been battling for years and years, and we're seeing now it just really, really starting to come to the public's eye and getting the acknowledgement that it deserves. But PTSD is a very real thing, and a lot of our folks are dealing with it, and we're now becoming aware of it more and more, and trying to intervene before it gets to some of the tragic things we're seeing, you know, unfortunately, every day now.
Well, and you mentioned some of these tragic events. We just celebrated, or I don't know if that's even the right word, but we just had the 17th anniversary of 9/11. We've had events around this country, really traumatic events, and you know, you're a trained professional. You're someone who has gone through many, many years of training. You've got a lot of experience. And I would imagine that the more people that are trained in terms of being able to deal with some of these injuries that are inflicted potentially could help save lives.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's really what we're talking about here with Citizen Aid because, you know, 23 years of getting off fire trucks and ambulances and being met by hysterical folks who say, you know, I just wanted to help, but I didn't know what to do. You know, that's a lot of years of just grating on my mind and soul. And so joined together with a fellow groups of people who have been in that same situation and who really understood the importance of how can we get the public to act before we arrive. And this world we live in, as you mentioned, where we see more and more violent incidents on the rise. What we did with Citizen Aid is we took the lessons learned on the battlefield, and you actually made reference to the correlation between war and what we're seeing on the streets. And we took lessons learned on the battlefield by our military and how they trained average infantrymen to save lives before medics arrived. And we took those programs and we contextualized them for the public and developed Citizen Aid. And we're putting it now into schools and churches and public transportation hubs, and now our first NFL stadium, which we'll announce next week. But yeah, the nucleus of it is free. So it's a free app that we encourage people to download, and it gives them a system of steps to keep themselves safe and to save other people's lives.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about, obviously, 9/11, shootings in Florida, and, you know, all different types of venues. Any type there's a public place, and it, you know, if there's a vulnerability and it's exploited, people can get hurt. And it's, you know, I guess from your training as a EMT, it's those first few minutes, I would imagine, that are, I mean, from the outsider's point of view, that are really critical to saving lives.
Absolutely. I mean, it's really the first 5 minutes, Jeffrey. So someone can die from an arterial wound in under 4 minutes. And, you know, the general public doesn't really know that. They're not familiar with that because, you know, that's just not their line of work. And so what we do is we want to educate and empower people that there's some very simple things that can be done to save lives. And what people need to know is, especially at a violent incident, is that help is not going to be arriving right away. And people just assume that, you know, when someone's critically injured, you dial 911 and a firefighter or paramedic walks in the door and saves the day. But in a violent incident, actually fire and EMS are staged down the road while police and law enforcement clear the scene and render the scene safe. Then they ask us to come in and aid the wounded. So that delay in care is exacerbated in a violent incident, and that's exactly when we need the public to step up. And so we've created this system of simple steps to save lives and lower preventable death.
And I mean, and kind of tying it back to what I was talking about earlier at the beginning of our segment with, you know, referencing Mr. Pinkman's discussion that I had about the importance of the pension and attracting workers, or excuse me, firefighters and police. If you don't have the firefighters and police, that's even more critical that the general public need to get involved. And I would just say, you know, when you're, you don't know what to do. If you know, the first thing you're thinking about is, am I okay if there's an event? And then is, if you're with a loved one or a friend or whomever, are they okay? But then, you know, I've taken, like, when I was a kid, and this is going back years, you know, we learned CPR, we learned some basic first aid, but, you know, nothing to the extent that would really do what you're suggesting.
Right. And we've made huge strides in this country with lowering death rates from sudden cardiac arrest by bringing, you know, the American Red Cross and American Heart Association have just done amazing things in teaching the public how to do good quality CPR and how to use AEDs. And we're seeing AEDs now prevalent throughout all public buildings and schools and so on and so forth. And so Citizen Aid is the exact same initiative. So how can we train the public to not be scared, but to be prepared and know what to do? And then how can we make that equipment readily available in public spaces? But if it's not available, how do we teach people how to improvise? And that's what our mission is to make people aware the same way they are about sudden cardiac arrest, about how to treat wounds that are serious and could be deadly if not acted upon quickly.
Yeah, you know, just kind of thinking this through, I mean, you think about some of these recent events at schools. If I was training to be a teacher, this would be the last thing that I would think about having to do. But now that these events are occurring, I wouldn't say it's part of the job, but it's something that you have to really consider. Like, how do I deliver first aid? How do I deliver support if something were to happen anywhere I was? And that's just an example of people who can learn something, right?
Right. And we opened our doors 8 days before the tragedies in Parkland, Florida. And obviously where schools were going to be a focus of ours. We have been inundated. We've done nothing but focus on the educational market, or the educational market is focused on us. And how do we get our message out, and how do we prepare teachers? Because it's not a political discussion. It doesn't have anything to do with guns. It has all to do with saving lives. And so what we've done is we've created online classes that one for the whole public and one for the teaching environment for educators and administrators and coaches. And we've decided to do a match. And so for every class that's taken by the public, we donate one to a teacher for free. So businesses can train their employees, and we give the businesses those matches that they can then, those matched classes that they can take to their local school districts and gift to those teachers and train the teachers. And so in just about 7 months, we've trained over 7,000 teachers for free. And our goal as an organization is to train 1 million U.S. educators free of charge. And we're well on our way. We're moving faster than actually I thought we were before we opened our doors. So it's exciting to see. It's so we're sorry that it's needed, but we know that it is. But we're just thrilled with the passion that people are having to be proactive and know what to do.
Yeah, I think that's just bringing it back to the American spirit. We all want to help each other, and that's what being an American is about, supporting one another. So Bob Otter, I want to thank you so much for coming on the show, and thanks for extending our conversation about police and firefighters and retirement, and also, I guess, what we can do in the public eye in order to help and protect ourselves and our fellow man. Have a great day.
Thank you, Jeffrey. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. And now we're going to check in our personal finance segment. Joining us now is Miss Alessandro Melito from MarketWatch. Hi, Allie.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well. And I should make a mention that Jacob Passy is off this week. So Miss Melito has volunteered to cover the entire segment herself. So we appreciate that. Lots going on with the market. Lots going on in personal finance news, Allie, but I think you've got some really interesting stories to talk about, one of which is Alexa being used to initiate trades and investing?
Yeah. So TD Ameritrade came out with this Alexa skill for your Echoes and other devices like that, where you can check the market, you could see what's going on in your own account, and now you can even make a trade order through a voice command.
Interesting.
So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, absolutely.
I spoke to some advisors, though, who said that they were a little concerned about that concept just because this is not just for, specialized investors. This could be literally anybody who's, in their kitchen cooking or sitting on the couch doing nothing, where they're able to hear a headline, especially this week, with the volatility and all that stuff, and, more of that, I'm sure, to come. If they hear something that scares them or they hear about a stock that they think is doing particularly well, they can now very easily jump on that. And one of the most important lessons I think advisors try to explain to their clients is that you should not just act emotionally when it comes to investing.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the biggest concern among advisors I spoke with, just that, for the everyday investor, this is not necessarily something that you really want to take advantage of.
Yeah. I mean, I echo your sentiments. The other piece of that, and I'm not sure if you got into this with your interviewees for your article, was the data privacy and the fact that we had some issues that we talked about with Ms. Walters in the technology segment about, the Alexa app eavesdropping on people. So I'm wondering if that came up at all with data privacy or, information at
so
all.
So I spoke with TD Ameritrade, and they said that as far as security goes, they have numerous things that you have to do before you're actually allowed to trade or do anything like that. So, it's voice command, it's your voice, although I'm not entirely sure if, your spouse tries to get into your account, what happened, but they said that they have a PIN, they have two-factor authentication, which I'm assuming also goes to your phone or your email, something like that. And she said that there were numerous steps to take before you actually are allowed to trade.
Well, great.
To see that trade through. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for that, Allie. Another story that I think you were working on or have worked on is around retirement for women. This is obviously a big topic. There's a lot of lot of that going on in the financial press. What did you learn in your efforts to cover this topic?
So I love covering retirement, and one, you know, I get studies and surveys all the time about, you know, how Americans are faring or how they think they're doing with retirement planning and all of that stuff. And one study that caught my attention said that 20% of women intend to rely on their spouse's money for retirement income, and 31% say that they know how much they need to save to reach their retirement goals. And yet less than half of women are confident they'll have enough money to last their retirement. So I thought it was really, really interesting that more than a third of women know how much, don't know how much to expect in retirement income. Only slightly more than a third of women know how much to expect in retirement income. Sorry, it's been a long week.
No.
Anyway.
I can relate. I can relate to that, by the way.
Thanks. So what's concerning to me is that, you know, whether you are in your 20s, your 30s, or you are in your 50s, you should have some sort of concept of what you will be receiving on a month-to-month basis when you are in retirement, just because that is the money that you will be relying on to pay whatever mortgage you have left or rent or groceries or anything that you actually want to do with the rest of your time. And I did a little bit of a roundup of some ways that you can look at this. So the good thing is, I guess it depends on an individual basis, but retirement income is usually broken up by various streams. It's not just, you know, one paycheck that you're getting. You're getting, you know, maybe some money from your retirement accounts. You're getting Social Security depending on your age or when you decide to claim. You might be getting a benefit from a spouse or a family member. And there are also alternatives that you can take. So I just pointed out some tips that people should consider if you are unaware of how much you are getting in retirement or don't even know an estimate. You should do things like, you know, go on the Social Security Administration's website, sign up for them so you can make sure that your pay history is, your working and pay history is correct, and then also get an idea of what you should be expecting in those benefits. And then you should also organize a lot of documents, talk to your spouse, talk to any family members if you think that you're a beneficiary, you know, just figure out what that's all about. Don't, you know, necessarily rely on that because, you know, there are a lot of what ifs in life. But have an idea, you know, make a roundup of these documents. And then if necessary, say that you're not getting enough money based on all these calculations, then look for alternatives. There are annuities, there are various types of brokerage accounts. There's all lots of, obviously, as you know, that you can consider just to make up for the difference. Or you might decide, as a lot of women and men do, you continue working, you know, maybe work a little longer, do a part-time job just to have that extra cash in your pocket. Say you want to go away or you want to buy your grandkids some
toys. I mean, a great point. And I know the point of the topic we were discussing was really around women, but those things you articulated, whether you're a man, a woman, a young person, a mature person, they all apply. And we need people to be very active in planning for their financial futures.
Yeah, absolutely.
Allie,
that's why I tell millennials all the time.
Absolutely.
Let's do it.
We got to keep the great work as always. You got to keep at it. Keep talking to your peers. Keep talking to people my age. We got to get the American people thinking about retirement. Allie, always great to talk with you. Great insight. Give Jacob our best when you talk to him and have a wonderful weekend.
Awesome. You too. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Welcome back to the show. And you know, our show would never be complete if we didn't have a conversation with our legal eagles, David Levine and Kevin Walsh from Groom Law Group. This week, a little bit of a change. David is recovering from National Retirement Security Week and probably some of the conference work that he was doing early in the week. So Mr. Kevin Walsh from Groom Law is joining us. And Kevin, thanks again for coming on. And how was your week?
Oh, I'm happy to be on. I think David would love to be here, but he's taken down the decorations and kind of all the accoutrement that goes along with National Retirement Security Week.
That's awesome. So we wish David the best. Hope he's relaxing. But I know you're out there talking to clients. You're going to conferences just like David is. you're in these conversations on Capitol Hill and with clients. What's top of mind for you? What's top of mind for the Eagles and Grumlaw?
So right now, and it with retirement, with there's so much going on, but the hot topic of the day really is MEPS. And we've talked about it a couple times in the show.
Yep.
And we were saying, you know, RESA could be the way that MEPS get done, which is a bill that's in the Senate, the Tax Cut and Jobs Act, or the new Tax Cuts 2.0. The House bill has an open MEP provision in it as well. But it turns out that the first real proposal to get traction now is on October 22nd, the Department of Labor issued a proposed rule designed to make it easier to offer multiple employer defined contribution plans. And
wow,
that's a whole lot of words. But what it means is that the Department of Labor is trying to find a way to make it easier for small employers, kind of sole proprietorships and independent contractors to get access to defined contribution plans like 401k plans.
That's awesome. And I know we have talked about this. You guys have been on top of things as the Eagles. You know, you have been soaring over Capitol Hill as on our episodes talking about this. And this is a follow-up on the presidential executive order, as you mentioned, and kind of another proposal in terms of solutions to those state-based retirement systems that we've talked about as well. You know, on my show, Rose to Retirement, I talked to the treasurer of California about their solution, Cal Savers. This is another solution, possible solution for these small employers to band together. So vital, so important for individuals who are working in that gig economy.
Yeah, so this really is. I mean, it's another route. You've had some state proposals, and now you've got kind of a federal proposal to make it easier for small employers to band together. Some of the key differences here when we focus on what's going on here versus what's going on in the legislation is that – so what Congress is looking at doing is largely making it so that any employers can band together to offer kind of a single plan. What the regulation here is looking to do, the proposed rule – it's expanding it, making it easier for employers to band together, but there's some limits on the amount of banding together. So you have to be either in kind of a common region, and they say based around the same city or in the same state, or you need to be kind of the same industry.
Right.
So it's a little bit different than the open MEP provision that we're seeing, the open MEP language that we're seeing on the Hill. But this is a step towards making it easier for small employers to offer plans.
I think it's absolutely amazing that this has moved so quickly, and gives me comfort that this is a top issue for, you know, on the heels of National Retirement Security Week, this is a top issue for the administration, for Department of Labor, all the regulators. And that's people who are stakeholders. I mean, this is really important.
Oh, my gosh. And you talk about how quick it is. I mean, the executive order came out on September 3rd, and it gave them 6 months to propose a rule. They didn't take a full 6 months. Basically, a month and a half later, they got this proposal out. So just with my experience with regulators, to do something in a month and a half, I mean, that's lightning fast.
So
it seems like it's a clear priority.
Yeah, definitely. And so just to give the context to the audience, and our audience is vast, so it's individuals, it's people who are in our business and outside of our business. What's the process from here? Take us through what could potentially be the timeline.
So the process from here is right now there's a comment period. So there's an opportunity. This is 100 pages of proposal. And what they're looking for is they want comments from individuals, they want comments from industry, they want comments from basically the affected community to help them figure out, are there ways to refine the proposal? Are there things that they should change? Is it good the way it is? And that comment period, it closes on Christmas Eve, so December 24th. So between here and there, it's unlikely that we'll see more regulatory action. However, once the comment period closes, it's likely that they'll take a few months to review those regulations and issue a final rule. Now, this has been moving quickly. So sometimes it takes years to go from proposed rule to final rule.
Mm-hmm.
This rule also largely tracks a rule that came out recently in the health side, allowing small employers to band together to offer health plans. So that rule, with that rule already in place, it wouldn't be shocking to see this finalized in the next 6 months.
Wow.
that's not to say that it couldn't take longer, but I mean, I'm guessing we'll have an opportunity to talk about a final rule sometime next spring. Now, with the legislation also, if Congress goes ahead and manages to get a proposal across the finish line that really provides for open MEPs, which is essentially that any employers can band together, then maybe this regulation gets put on hold. Mm-hmm. But this really seems to be something that's moving.
Very interesting. Last 30 seconds. I mean, we've got midterm elections coming up. There could be change in the control of the House and the Senate. Does any of that play into this with the ruling from the Department of Labor? Not ruling, but the comment period from the Department of Labor. I mean, could that change things as well?
So where I think the election is going to play the biggest role is in terms of putting pressure on Congress to get some retirement legislation across the finish line. We're very fortunate as an industry that there's generally bipartisan support for making positive changes to make it easier for people to save. That being said, we frequently kind of we're watching legislation that's very popular that both parties support kind of sit on hold. After the election, I mean, if the Democrats take the House, it provides Republicans kind of one last opportunity with both chambers to get something across the finish line. On the other hand, we know the Democrats, that Democrat House leaders have indicated that they really want to support some retirement legislation. So the election is kind of an inflection point, mm-hmm. and it may shape what happens going forward. But in our area, it seems like both parties seem to be on the same side.
Well, that's good to hear. I mean, at least there's some level of bipartisan and cooperation going on, and retirement's so important. It affects everyone, and it's nice to see that both sides of the aisle can step up. We're going to have to leave it there, Kevin. Thank you so much. Give our best to David. I'd love to have the Legal Eagles back next week, but we know people are busy and recovering. So have a great weekend, and thanks for your contribution.
Oh, thanks for having me on. Have a great week.
Thanks, bud. Bye.
Bye.
Well, that wraps up yet another edition of the Weekly Pulse podcast. I'm Jeff Snyder. Thanks for joining us. Special thanks to Bob Otter of CitizenAid. And, of course, special thanks to our all-stars. Great having them contribute and share their expertise. And thank you to our audience. We love having you join us, and we look forward to providing this content to you on a weekly basis. So have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you next week on the Weekly Pulse.